Thanks very much for the invitation this evening. I was asked to talk about the open access experiment in science and medicine, which I think is proving to be a successful one, and what the lessons are for the social sciences and humanities. And I wanted to just start with some stories from science and medicine, because I think some of these stories bring those issues alive. I was in Ethiopia a couple of years ago, was training African Medical Journal editors, and I met James Tumwene, who's a professor of paediatric infectious diseases, and he'd just been asked by the WHO to investigate an outbreak in southern Sudan, an outbreak of a disease called nodding disease. It's called that because when children eat, they have an absence seizure, and they nod off. So the first thing, of course, that Dr. Tumwene does is goes online to search the literature to see what's been written about nodding disease. But unfortunately, he couldn't, because the articles cost typically $30 or $40 per article. He lives in Uganda, where the annual healthcare budget is $9 per person per year. So the idea that he's going to be able to access the literature is, of course, nonsense. The problem, then, with this model, this for-profit subscription-based model, is it relies on restricting access and selling papers only to the rich. So you have this potential treasury of medical knowledge, life-saving medical knowledge, that only a small section of society can ever access, and knowledge that is being used by publishers to make enormous profits. And I think that paradigm is completely wrong. I believe very passionately that these research results should be considered a global public good, that the entire public should be able to access, and not just the rich minority. In my view, as a physician with an interest in global health, is that this restricted access is a global public health crisis. The solution, of course, arrived with the internet. Harold Varmus, the Nobel laureate, one of the founders of PLOS, said when the internet arrived and it made it possible to share results, it's now possible to share the results of medical research with anyone, anywhere who could benefit from it. How could we not do it? I mean, we have a moral imperative, surely, to do it. So, tonight I wanted to talk about this current medical and scientific status quo. And I want to argue that the system, the current system, is broken, unsustainable, and it's getting in the way of science and scientific progress and health. I want to present an alternative from the science and medicine world, open access biomedical publishing, which I think the social sciences and humanities have a lot to learn from. I'm not sure the models can be the same in open access social sciences, and we can hopefully have a fruitful discussion about that. And I want to then pose the question, why has progress been slow in open access to social sciences and humanities, and how can the social sciences community get there? So the current system then in science and medicine, I'm sure it's pretty similar in social sciences, is you typically spend 3, 4, 5 years doing your research, and then maybe a year writing it up. And then something bizarre happens. You give it to a publisher, and you don't own it anymore. You don't own your own work. You even often have to buy copies of your own work. You're giving a class to, say, 100 or 200 students. You have to pay to give them copies of your work. A totally bizarre system. And certainly in medicine, the stakes, the financial stakes, are incredibly high. They're not as high as in the social sciences, but a paper in a medical journal can earn that journal about $1 million. One article, $1 million. High-profile drug trial in a journal like the New England Journal of Medicine. And the journal subjects that work to extremely tight copyright restrictions, limiting what anyone can do with that paper. And because of the cost of journals, hundreds of dollars for a subscription, because of the cost of individual downloads, typically $30 or $40, only a very tiny, tiny proportion of the potential audience worldwide can see it. If you want to subscribe to a journal, which I'm sure is fascinating, called Brain Research, it will cost you $21,000. So, research funders have started to get very interested in this business. They fund the research, and yet the research that they fund ends up in journals that make it impossible for most of the world to access the research that they have funded. In fact, the Wellcome Trust, the world's largest biomedical private research funder, they got interested in this issue because the director, he'd heard that one of his grantees had made some great progress towards a malaria vaccine. So he goes online, he thinks, I've got to see this paper. We have funded this research that is making progress towards a malaria vaccine. And he was astonished to find access denied to work that he had funded. So many research funders are getting interested in this. And the Wellcome Trust has now commissioned two studies on this current system. And they say that with this current system, the publishing of scientific research doesn't operate in the interests of society or the public, but is instead dominated by a commercial market intent on improving its market position. This is about commerce. This is about profit. This is not clearly about dissemination of information worldwide. This slide that I wanted to show you, you actually might be able to see. The top one, the red line, shows journal prices, and the middle line shows the rate of inflation. Wow! How's that? How's the angle? Is that good? Yeah. Basically, there's a line at the top. I mean, I'm joking.
The old-fashioned way.
The old-fashioned way, look at that. Oh. We don't need anything high-tech.
Find some chalk.
So here's the rate of inflation. Something like that. And here is what journal prices are doing year on year for the last 30 years. And that's been called a death spiral. Because what's actually happening is, because journals are so expensive, people are cancelling their subscriptions. And because people are cancelling their subscriptions, to compensate, the journals are putting their prices higher and higher and higher. And it's a death spiral that very few journal publishers seem willing to escape. There is a slide that I wanted to show you that's my favourite slide of all. And it's what happens when you go online to a particular journal and you don't have a subscription. It's an article that's called Impediments to Promoting Access to Global Knowledge in Sub-Saharan Africa. And if you cannot get online, if you don't have a subscription, it will cost you $25, which is quite ironic. Since I'm at a university tonight, I thought I would just remind you that Derrida had warned that the university risked becoming a branch chain of corporations, and his worst nightmare has come true. Academics, they hand their work to publishers. Publishers make millions and millions of dollars from academics' work, the university never sees a penny of it. Branch chains of corporations. So, certainly in science and medicine, this traditional model, subscription-based model, only the rich can read it, isn't serving society. It's not serving medicine. Most potential audiences can't reach it. The economics of it are based on an old-fashioned system of paper and binding and printing. There are limits placed on the ability to search the literature, absolutely crucial in science and medicine, to be able to search all the studies ever done on a topic, pull out all the data and meta-analyze them. Copyright restrictions are limiting use. And very importantly, patients who altruistically agree to participate in clinical trials for the public good are prevented from reading the results of the research they altruistically participated in. And all this is, in my view, getting in the way of global health promotion, which is my own personal interest. There's all sorts of ways in which it's doing it, at least six that I can think of. Firstly, and most obviously, health workers are starved of information. And we know that one of the most effective and cost-effective ways of improving the health of poor nations is to increase access to reliable knowledge to healthcare workers. So why aren't we doing it? The late Jim Grant, the director of UNICEF, he calculated that about 60% of deaths in the developing world are preventable by the application of knowledge. Now, I'm not saying that, you know, if we got the New England Journal of Medicine to everyone in Africa, all would be fine. It's not as simple as that. But access to knowledge has to be a component. Another way in which impedes global health is that we know that the capacity to do research in developing countries is at the moment poor, and part of that is because of a lack of access to knowledge. There are many other reasons for poor research capacity. We know also that lack of access creates an incredibly unequal world. In my job, every day, I talk with authors and peer reviewers in the South, and it can never be an equal conversation. If you're setting policy, and you have policymakers around a table, and half of them have read the latest studies on, for example, preventing mother-to-child transmission of HIV, and half haven't, it can never be an equal conversation. Right now, in the medical literature, just the abstracts of articles are free, short 200-word summaries. Unfortunately, studies have shown that abstracts are often wrong. In fact, they're probably usually wrong. So it's very dangerous to rely on abstracts. And the last reason I find an interesting one. Medical journals, traditional medical journals, there's one called the New England Journal of Medicine, you may have heard of it, it's a local journal. They publish very little that has anything of relevance to the developing world. In fact, a study last year in the journal Globalization Health found that less than 3% of the content of the New England Journal of Medicine had any relevance to the developing world. The developing world, of course, has about 90% of the burden of all disease. Why the mismatch? Partly it's because of this business model. If you rely on rich people buying content, you have to publish content that's going to appeal to the rich people. If you rely on selling reprints of the articles you own to drug companies, you have to publish papers that drug companies are going to buy. They're not going to buy papers about leprosy in Africa or maternal mortality in India. And if you rely on selling drug ads, again, you have to have a journal that appeals to drug advertisers in the West. In the biomedical world, and I'm not sure it's happened yet in social sciences, but I'd be interested to hear about your experience. There has been the seeds of a revolution, a mutiny. You've had university resolutions saying it's time for academics to take back ownership of their work. There have been editors of science journals resigning and saying this is ridiculous and starting their own alternatives more freely available. You've had over 30,000 scientists signing a letter, an open letter to publishers, calling on the publishers to do more around public access. And right now there's a petition in Europe, over 10,000 signatories so far, asking the European Commission to make this work more publicly available. And what emboldened all these rebels? Of course it was the arrival of the internet, meaning that you can disseminate articles at no charge to readers worldwide, and there is extraordinary potential of reuse. I mean, if I publish a paper in PLOS, if I write an article in PLOS, I can send the PDF to 1,000 people in under a second. Extraordinary ability to disseminate and reuse. Now, of course, I'm not saying that it's free to create that PDF. It isn't. There are costs involved in mediating peer review, in copy editing, in creating the PDF, and in hosting it on a secure server. That cost is a relatively small cost, and it's a one-time fixed cost. So if that cost can be recovered up front, there is no reason on earth why you have to charge readers to access the PDF. And that's the model for biomedical open access publishing. In the days of print, you could argue it made sense to charge readers, right? If you were a publisher and you published, say, 2,000 copies of your science journal, every time you created one, printing, binding, mailing, it cost you an incremental amount. It's an expensive business, print. But in the online world, as an online biomedical publisher, what we do now has a one-time fixed cost. That is peer review, copy editing, creating the PDF. One-time fixed cost. So it makes no sense to charge all 2,000 people to read that PDF, because it's not costing the publisher an incremental amount every time a person reads it. If 2,000 people read it, or if one person reads it, the cost is about the same to the publisher. And that's the model that the biomedical publishing enterprise that's transitioning to open access is adopting. It's the service provider model, the midwife model. We help to deliver the baby, but we don't keep the baby afterwards. One thing that works in medicine and science that I suspect wouldn't work in the social sciences is that the grants are pretty enormous, right? A typical grant from the US NIH is about $300,000 or $400,000 for a research project. So in our world, we can say, look, the person who should be paying this upfront one-time fixed cost is the research funder. It's in their interests to disseminate this work. So we're saying, okay, set aside 1% of the grant to make this work freely available. I suspect it's not a model that would transition easily to social sciences, and I hope to talk about what will work in the social sciences later. So, I have a lovely slide showing all the PLOS journals. This is the background to the PLOS journals. We started in 2003 with PLOS Biology, and then PLOS Medicine in 2004. PLOS Biology and PLOS Medicine deliberately set out to be journals that looked and felt like Nature, Science, the New England Journal of Medicine, and the Lancet. People were saying, well, it's all very well, you know, the idea that we should be sharing our work with the world, but all these top-tier journals, they're all restricted access. I mean, what do you want us to do? So we said, okay, we're going to create alternatives. They are edited by professional editors like myself, and they have the look and the feel of these other top-tier journals, because we wanted to show that it's perfectly possible to be open access and very high quality. The next phase were journals that were run by the community for the community, without professional editors. And those are on course to be entirely self-sustaining, with a little bit of support from PLOS, basically run by the community. And the latest phase, which I would have loved to have shown you, with incredible levels of interaction between the community and the journal, the ability for readers to annotate the actual research articles, start discussion threads around them, add their own secondary materials. We're calling Open Access 2.0, PLOS 1 is the latest example. So what do we mean in the biomedical world by open access? We mean something very specific, Not just that it's free to access, i.e. there's no economic barrier, but crucially, it is free to use. So everything we publish is published under the Creative Commons Attribution License. So readers are free to make a million copies if they want. We published in PLOS Medicine, for example, the world's first study showing that circumcision reduces the chances of HIV in men having heterosexual sex by about 60%. One of the most important studies ever in HIV medicine. If you are a health minister, you can make a million copies of that article and send it to every single health professional in the country. You can create derivative works. You can put it into newsletters. You can translate it. You can pull out the figures. You can do whatever you like that is legal, provided you give credit to the authors, and you cite the source. So the authors retain the copyright, which in this situation means the right to be credited and for the source to be cited. And the author grants the public the right to reuse those materials. And very importantly, within science and medicine, very importantly, on the day that we published the paper in PLOS Medicine, we put a copy of it, the full text obviously, into PubMed Central. That's the federally run database of full text articles. So you have a single place for all full text articles. Well, not all, because very few publishers agree to do it. But one day our vision is that all the papers will be there, allowing very sophisticated searching and mining across the literature. So with this license, copyright is being used for what it was meant to in science. Copyright was never meant to be used as a way of publishers making $11 billion a year. That was never what was intended for. And with this radical new kind of licensing, copyright can be used to maximize the impact of a research article and not restrict the impact. And we know from study after study after study now that open access articles get cited more quickly and they get cited more frequently. It's hardly a surprise, but now empirical research is showing that. I wanted to show you some really lovely examples of how our materials are being used in very creative ways. So I'm now going to have to sort of describe these beautiful videos and so on. We see our articles being translated into different languages every single day. So I was going to show you an example of a PLOS Medicine paper that appeared in a Spanish newspaper. Now I was going to show you a lovely photo of a monkey, and the reason I was going to show it is it's a study in PLOS Biology of a three-day-old monkey imitating a researcher. The researcher sticks out his tongue, and then the monkey, the three-day-old macaque, so cute, looks at the researcher and sticks out its tongue. Never been shown before. We didn't know before this study that neonatal monkeys actually imitated. And the reason I showed you that video is because the following slide shows what the New York Times did with this paper the next day. They created a module that had the videos and figures and data, and they were free to do that, to create this module for high school teachers called Monkey See, Monkey Do, because of this license. I mean, this is what science should be about. Actually, this might work. I'm going to play you a singing mouse. And this is another study from PLOS Biology, ultrasonic songs of male mice. And it was the first study that showed that when male mice are courting female mice, they sing to them. It's a true song, not just random noises. They actually sing to them. And with a bit of luck, if I turn the volume up, you might be able to hear what a male mouse sounds like when he is courting a female mouse. They've slowed it down, I think. A bit like a wolf whistle. There you go, that is a male mouse singing to a female mouse. And the reason that I wanted to share this male mouse song is because the next day we got an incredibly heartwarming letter from a science teacher. She wrote, "Dear Public Library of Science people," I think that's us, "I just listened to your mouse song online and I wanted to tell you how grateful I am for your journal. I'm a middle school science teacher. I do not have the funds to subscribe to the traditional science journals. Tomorrow, my students will hear the same mouse song I listened to, and I'm sure they'll be as enchanted and interested as I am. The idea of open access to original research papers is very exciting to someone in my position. I can assure you that the availability of research papers will benefit the future of scientific research by providing motivation and stimulation for millions of fledgling scientists. Yours, science teacher." So, those are some of the ways in which we see our materials being used. The other way in which we know that open access benefits the science community, it's a little bit hard to do without demonstrating, is that you can go from the literature seamlessly integrated to databases. So you can go to the full text article in PubMed Central, this federally funded full text database, and you can link from that to a gene database and find out all about the gene that was mentioned in the paper. And from that gene database, you can find out about homologous genes in other species, and you can keep going forever. So you don't just have this network of literature, you have this network of literature and databases, which in science is immeasurably richer. And then the last point that I wanted to make about the benefits of open access is text mining and data mining. Now, if you're a scientist or you're a clinical researcher, there is no way in a million years you can know about every single paper that's out there. However, a machine can know about it, and a machine control the literature. At the moment, those machines are only being used to trawl the abstracts, those 200-word summary, because the full text is locked away behind access tolls and copyright barriers. So if you're a researcher, and let's say you're trying to discover a new drug for Alzheimer's disease, and you're trying to think about new biochemical pathways in the brain, you can't know about all the biochemical studies going on, but a machine can make the linkage. So when every single article is made open access, free to read, free to use, we are going to discover new knowledge through this text mining. It's not happening because open access is not happening. And before moving on to talking about social sciences, I wanted to talk about our newest project. Again, a little bit difficult to demonstrate. PLOS One. PLOS One is an attempt to come up with the perfect scientific research journal. The perfect research journal, every article will be open access, obviously, free to read, free to use. Alongside the research article, you'd have the underlying data, very valuable, particularly if people don't believe your study and they want to check it for themselves. As I said, you'd integrate the literature with useful databases. You'd have multiple levels of peer review, not just peer review by a few select scientists, one or two that you ask to have a look at the paper. The whole world of scientists can annotate and comment. You'd be able to search this database of of papers and so on, to tailor your search to your specific and individual needs. And all of this you'd be able to access by a single entry point. And that's what we have created with PLOS One. What I can't demonstrate, but if anyone is online, just go to plosone.org. You'll see a tab that says most annotated, and you'll be able to draw up the papers that have been most annotated. So a user, a reader, can make a little mark, number one comment, and if you click on that mark, up comes the reader's comment about that sentence, or about that table, or about that figure. You can also start a discussion thread around the paper. And last week we started a fantastically interesting project where we've got communities of scientists around the world using these papers as a journal club. The big thing in science is the weekly journal club, where an article comes out in the journal and everyone in the lab talks about it and discusses what it means and what it means to them. You can do this with a PLOS One paper now, and your lab can annotate it and start discussion threads. The University of Sydney Perception Group did this to a paper on perception, on human perception. And then the authors responded to all these comments and annotations. So you have this fantastic continual loop of analysis and discussion and refinement. This is the great power of the web, harnessing collective intelligence. In a recent article in the BMJ about Web 2.0 in medicine by a medical librarian, said the more that we share, use, and exchange information on the web in a continual loop of analysis and refinement, the more open and creative the platform becomes, and hence the more useful it is in our work. The fantastic thing about knowledge is that if I use it, it doesn't reduce the usefulness to another person. Economists call this a non-rivalrous good. In fact, the wonderful thing about knowledge is that the more that people use it, the more useful it becomes because of this analysis and refinement. Because we're going to be talking about social sciences in a minute, I also wanted to mention an alternative pathway to having greater public access in science and medicine. And I know that it's a pathway that is catching on in the social sciences. And that is the idea of archiving your work. So instead of publishing open access journals, some publishers say to their authors, well, we'll let you put a copy of the article, not the corrected final version, good God no, the uncorrected one, into a repository, your institutional digital repository or a subject-based one. Provided, A, we can still own all the copyright, and B, you must put a link to the final corrected version on our website that remains behind an access barrier. It's an important step. It's a step in the right direction. You may have heard in the open access world of the green road and the gold road, and some people call open access publishing what we do the gold road, but there are steps you could take along the green road. I don't think it's the answer, but I think it's an important step. I think it's a bit inefficient to have these uncorrected versions in a million different repositories all around the world. The viability of some of these repositories remains uncertain. Their stability remains uncertain. In medicine, it disturbs me that there are uncorrected versions out there, because we know that at copy editing, we discover all sorts of problems, doses that are wrong, and so on. There are almost no publishers in science and medicine, different in the social sciences, there are almost no publishers that will let you go back and replace the uncorrected version with the final version, because they make money off selling that final version. So this version control is a problem. Authors obviously need to do the archiving themselves, which can create a barrier. And as I said, the copyright problem still remains. It might be free to read this uncorrected version, but it's definitely not free to reuse it for all legal purposes. And I wanted to just situate PLOS within a wider movement called the Knowledge Commons Movement, which some people think is going to be as influential as the environmental movement of the last few decades. A movement to create this body of knowledge that the entire public can access and can reuse. And within science and medicine, there are some fantastic, inspiring initiatives like the Conservation Commons, building a public library of data about conservation. The Drugs for Neglected Diseases Initiative, a public sector initiative to develop drugs for neglected diseases of poverty, they have agreed to make the final products public domain. And Science Commons, working hard to remove barriers to scientific collaboration. And I wanted to show you a wonderful slide of open source beer. There it is, free beer. Group of students in Denmark at the University of Copenhagen, they put their great minds together to solve one of the crucial challenges of our time, producing open source beer. There was a recent open source beer party in San Francisco where everyone made Forest Oral, the name of this beer, and I have to say, it's a little bit insipid, but there you go. There's just a couple of points I wanted to make before transitioning to talking about social sciences. There is enormous international support for open access to science and medicine, enormous. The UN supports it, formally. There was a declaration, the Berlin Declaration, signed by over 100 science organisations, National Academy of India, National Academy of China. There is this extraordinary movement and momentum. The NIH wants it to happen. The Wellcome Trust, as I said, wants it to happen. Research funders the world over have said, yes, we will support open access publishing. If our grantees need to pay this one-time fixed cost, we will cover that cost. That is happening in science and medicine. And indeed, the Federal Research Public Access Act, which is awaiting reintroduction in Congress, bipartisan, one Republican senator, one Democrat, are supporting an act that would see federally funded research made freely available. An act that has enormous support from scientists and patients and so on. Huge, huge resistance from both the big publishing corporations and also some of the society publishers who are also profiting from restricted access. So, what does all this mean for the social sciences and humanities? Well, there's no doubt that the open access movement has been a bit slower in your world. Sigi Jokhant from the Open Humanities Press, a new initiative that wants to be the PLOS of the humanities world, says, compared with its stunning success in the sciences, the uptake of open access publishing has been much slower in the humanities, and it continues to be met with resistance by many scholars. And Dan Hunter, a law professor, says, American law reviews are almost completely unaware of the possibilities of open access publishing models. That, thankfully, is changing, and I'm going to mention that in a minute. That quote is from a paper of his called Walled Gardens. He put a preprint of it into the Social Sciences Research Network, a repository. He published it under the Creative Commons Attribution License, and I found his little comment rather witty. He says, this document is released under the Creative Commons Attribution License. This means you can do anything you like with this document. For example, you may sing it in E above high C at your local light opera society. You may translate it into Farsi and broadcast it using ham radio. You may perform it as a mime around a campfire, as long as you attribute it to the author. Why has there been such a slow uptake of open access to the social sciences and humanities? Well, I'm not a social scientist, but in preparing for this talk, I phoned around and I brainstormed and I talked to people like Michael Carroll and I phoned the Duke Law Journal and I tried to canvass, you know, what are the things that are the impediments here? What are people afraid of? It seems there's still a perception, to some extent by scholars, that free things are not quite right. You know, they can't be good if they're free. That open access journals must be sort of academically inferior. The other issue is that I mentioned brain research costing $21,000. Stratospheric prices. You don't really get that in the social sciences. The prices are going up and up and up, but they haven't reached these stratospheric heights. And as a result, as far as I know, and you can correct me, there haven't been in the social sciences this mutiny and this revolution. Also, there hasn't been a long history of sharing preprints, unlike the physics world, which has archive.org for the last 20 years or so. Every physicist on the planet has been sending a preprint of their article to archive.org. And there isn't a federal library for full-text social sciences research, which there is for medicine. PubMed Central, and there is for education, Eric. And I think that the time to publication is probably less urgent in the social sciences world. In medicine, we often get authors phoning us and saying, look, we've got this paper, we think it's going to change public health practice. People need to know about this as soon as possible. Will you fast track it? And we agree to peer review it and get it out as quick as we can. It doesn't tend to happen as much in social sciences. And as I said, in medicine and science, there have been these international declarations saying that, you know, for the sake of development, human development, poverty alleviation, we need to make this happen. And again, you can correct me, and I'd be interested to hear, that I don't know of any UN declarations on the importance of sharing social sciences research. And here's just a typical comment. This is from Rick Weiss in the Washington Post, who writes, why is it a growing number of people are asking that anyone can download medical nonsense from the web for free, but citizens must pay to see the results of carefully conducted biomedical research that was financed by their taxes? The Public Library of Science aims to change that. There is a clamour for freely available medical research. Indeed, there's a group of patient advocates, the Alliance for Taxpayer Access, that wants to see federally funded research publicly available. And we get criticised all the time for what we do by big publishing companies. And one of the commonest criticisms is patients don't want to read this. They can't read it. They're too dumb to read it. Why are you wasting your time? Not only is this patronising, it's actually factually incorrect. We know, because we track what happens to our research papers, we know that patients are reading it. And as a physician, I've had patients come into my clinic who know more about their illness than I do. They become experts in their illness. They often know way more than the physician. So I find that attitude factually incorrect and rather patronising. So it's been slower in the social sciences world, but I, having thought about this over the last few weeks and having spoken to people, I actually think the issues are very, very similar. The first issue that's similar is that there is an impending crisis in social sciences and humanities journals, an impending serials crisis, because library budgets for these journals are getting smaller and smaller, and the prices are going up and up and up and up. I found a study showing that the costs of economics journals have gone up 49% from 2000 to 2004. Siggy Yotkan says, librarians feel themselves increasingly locked into a system in which they exert less and less bibliographic control over what's being bought by their limited funds. So that's the first issue that is the same. That's going to be happening eventually. It's an impending serials crisis. The second issue that's the same is that there are equivalent vested commercial interests at stake in the social sciences and humanities world. Siggy Yotkan says, decisions concerning the production, publication, dissemination and promotion of humanities research are being made by scholarly and commercial presses on economics grounds. And in his paper, Walled Gardens, Dan Hunter tells a story of how the California Law Review ordered the Social Sciences Research Network to take down three of his preprints. He thought this was rather odd and rather curious, and it turns out that the California Law Review was worried about revenue. It gets revenue when people come to Dan's papers via Lexis and Westlaw. And they were worried that if people went to SSRN to see his papers, they'd be out of a nice, tidy earner. Dan says, many of the top law reviews are acting as stalking horses for the commercial interests of legal database providers. So this second issue, I think, is very, very similar. Vested commercial interests. And I mentioned the Federal Research Public Access Act. And there are society publishers, like the American Anthropological Association, and I find this so deeply depressing, who are fighting against this act. Because, again, they are worried about their revenue that they get from hoarding anthropological research. You can get this rather bizarre situation because of these vested commercial interests, where you might be in a class, and through your course fees, you're paying to read your own professor's work. I mean, it's an absolutely bizarre situation. If you're a professor and you want to create a course pack, a set of journal articles, you have to pay this organisation called the Copyright Clearance Centre. All the publishers get royalties on these photocopies. And you, as students, are paying the costs. You're paying to read articles produced by your own faculty. What a bizarre, bizarre situation. Dare de sphere of the university as a branch chain of a corporation in action. So that's the second issue that I think is the same. The first issue then is this impending cereals crisis. The second issue are these commercial interests. And the third is that access tolls are reducing the reach and impact of social sciences and humanities research. I try to find out how many subscribers a typical social sciences journal has. And for Canada, I found data on Canada. The average social sciences journal, because it's so expensive, has 561 subscribers. Now, if I was a social sciences researcher, and after 10 years of work, I knew that only 561 people saw it, I'd give up. I'd be so depressed. And we know that the problem, of course, is particularly acute in low-income countries that don't have the revenue to buy subscriptions. I wanted to show you a journal called the Social Science Journal. It's an Elsevier journal. I don't have a subscription, and I wanted to show you the same thing that happens. I tried to look up a study that I thought looked interesting, an examination of earnings inequality and mobility among young full-time workers in the US. It would cost me $30 to access that single paper. So the issues are the same. And it's sad that journals aren't taking advantage of open access, because we know that open access increases citations, and not just in the biomedical world. This is a figure that shows, I don't know, can you see that? It's just lots of bars. And all these bars are showing an increase in citation with open access compared to closed access journals. And the reason for showing it is that the disciplines include sociology, law, business, political sciences, and economics, not just biology and medicine. Open access increases citations across all disciplines. The fourth issue that is the same is that at the very beginning of my talk, I talked about this guy, James Tumwine, being sent on a mission to southern Sudan to investigate an outbreak, and he couldn't do his job. He couldn't do his job because he couldn't get information. Michael Carroll tells a similar story, quasi-hypothetical. He says, imagine it's the 1970s, you're a sole lawyer, a legal practitioner working on your own, and a woman comes to you, and she's got a rare form of cervical cancer. It's called adenocarcinoma. Women who took the drug diethyl stilbestrol, which was used in those days for morning sickness, they have a higher risk of giving birth to daughters who go on to develop this cancer. And this woman, who's walked into your office, her mum took DES, this drug, in pregnancy. You think, wow, you've got a pretty strong case here. Unfortunately, the courts have ruled in the defendant's favour in analogous cases before. But you know, you can remember that there was an article by a law student in a law review that has the theory, the legal theory, industry liability, that you need to make your case. Sadly, you can't afford a subscription to the journal that that law review, that that article is in, and you definitely don't have time to be trawling the library. You turn down the case. Now fast forward to 2007. You're a sole legal practitioner. You cannot afford Westlaw, LexisNexis. There is no way you've got time to trawl the library. Michael Carroll says, whether you pursue this young woman's case now turns entirely on whether your internet search leads you to the student comment. For if you were to find it, you'd be willing to devote yourself to presenting this theory to a court. And if you did, and if you pursued this theory on appeal, you would win. This issue matters. It matters to professionals doing their job. And the fifth issue is that it also matters to the public. Now, in my world, health and medicine, it's very easy. There's great stories that you can tell to make the case that the public benefits enormously from having access. But we know there are parents who go online when their child is diagnosed with a rare disease, and they are hungry for information. But you could also argue that there are families who are hungry for legal information, who have a right to inform themselves. We know that there are all sorts of groups that could benefit from social sciences research. Anti-poverty organisations, union organisers, not just health activists. Michael Carroll writes, lawyers, students of the law, clients and inquisitive members of the public deserve ready access to the law and legal scholarship. I can't see anything that should stop a closed access social sciences journal transitioning to open access. I don't see any fatal barrier in the way. The benefits of the internet are there. Freedom to reuse, freedom to access. The benefits of these radical new licenses, the Creative Commons licenses, are there. The software is free. Open journal systems from the Public Knowledge Project, completely free. You can do the peer review, the tracking of the manuscripts, and the publishing of the journal, completely free. Huge savings to be made from abandoning print, transitioning to an open source journal managing system. We know, of course, that if everyone became open access, all this money being used for subscriptions, huge pot of money, would no longer have to be paid for subscriptions and could be used to support open access publishing. And there are all sorts of additional sources of revenue, governments, foundations, endowments, universities. If people still wanted to purchase copies, they could. We create print copies of PLOS journals for anyone who wants them on demand, and there's nothing to stop you if you wanted to make some extra profit on that. And you can still continue to get revenue from Lexis and Westlaw if you so wish. I mean, people can go, hopefully, to your open access journal and find it right there, but there will always be legal firms who would prefer to use these search engines. And many journals, many open access journals, continue to get revenue from those. So I looked around and I actually found that there was a growing social sciences open access journal movement. In the directory of open access journals that Lund University keeps, I found, for example, 43 anthropology journals, 38 media journals, 108 social science journals, 177 educational journals, 53 in law, and 63 in political science. I was just going to show you a few home pages of some of these. E-Sharp, Educational Social Sciences, Humanities and Arts Reviews for postgraduates produced by the University of Glasgow, completely funded up front by the university. Culture Machine. Oh yeah, so that's interesting. Generating research in culture and theory, open access. And an increasing number of law journals. The Creative Commons has a law project. The Open Access Law Programme, helping journals to transition to open access through a set of principles they're calling the Open Access Law Journal Principles. Under these principles, the journal still has a license on the work, but it's a limited term license. The journal allows the author to have a copy of the PDF, which she or he can post on a repository, and they can use a Creative Commons non-commercial attribution license. And this publication agreement is posted online. And I found 34 law reviews that signed up so far, including the Harvard Journal of Law and Technology. Fantastic. But I was I noted that the Harvard Law Review wasn't signed up. So there you go. Heidi Bond from the Michigan Law Review says, open access policies make for happier authors and better scholarship. After all, law review articles are like software. They're best when they're free for others to learn from and build on. So I phoned the editors of the Duke Law Journal last week, because I noted they'd been open access since 1997. It's pretty amazing. It's pretty radical. It's pretty forward-thinking. And I said, how do you do it? And Jamie Markham, one of the editors, said, well, we subscribe to these principles, these Creative Commons law principles. The authors are free to use the work for educational purpose. The readers are free to do so. And the author is free to post the PDF online. We want them to cite the original source, which they are always happy to do. They still have some print subscribers, about 1,100. That brings in a little bit of revenue. They use volunteers, and that's very interesting. There's a tradition in the social sciences of volunteerism, a bit less so in medicine and science. They use an open source, free online journal management system. There's no costs. They still get some revenue from Lexis and Westlaw. No one has to use Lexis or Westlaw to reach these articles. They're all open access. But there are many people who find it more convenient to do so. And they have surplus revenue. This is a journal open access, it brings in surplus revenue that in fact is supporting many of the other law journals at Duke. I mentioned the Open Humanities Press. They want to show that the same is possible for humanities publications. So who's going to pay in the social sciences and humanities? Now, I accept that the grants are smaller. You're not getting these $500,000 grants from the NIH. I'm sure you'd be delighted to. So the idea of setting aside 1% of that grant isn't going to work. And the subscriptions do cost less. But there is money in the system. I mean, someone is paying right now for all these social science journal subscriptions. So there is money that can be used. There's a long tradition of volunteerism, long histories of endowments, huge economic savings. And by creating cooperatives, social science and humanities journals can transition to open access. And they can actually bring in additional revenues by doing so. I wanted to show you the maths behind this. If someone is really interested in the maths, perhaps I can show you afterwards, because I have data that looks at a traditional subscription-based social science journal and an open access cooperative journal. And by transitioning, you can actually bring in more revenue. There's certain assumptions in that model, but it's totally doable. And in the way that I talked about what the perfect science journal might look like, you can imagine the same limitless possibilities with the perfect social sciences journal. Obviously open access, free to read, free to use, with the data alongside it, and integrated with other resources in social sciences, open access monographs and books and videos, seamless integration, multiple levels of peer review, no reason why you can't do it, plus one, it's open source technology. If you want to start creating annotations and comments in your journals, you are free to do that. And in the interim, along the green road, most publishers will allow you, as academics, to post a version into a digital repository, such as the Social Sciences Research Network or the Berkeley Electronic Print. Here's a quote from someone who did that. They self-archived. Self-archiving in the PhilSci archive has given instant worldwide visibility to my work. As a result, I was invited to submit papers to referee international conferences, and I got them accepted. And there's software out there to create your own institutional repository. Open source, free software. In fact, Duke has created an institutional repository. There's an academic there who's been watching the process of what happened after creating a repository. And he thought, what's going to happen to the law journals? Are people going to stop going to the law journals if we have this repository of all our academics' work? And that didn't happen. In fact, they found that some journals saw an increase in print subscriptions. And they also thought, well, are people going to come to the Duke repository to look for a paper, or are they going to go to SSRN or the Berkeley Electronic? What are they doing? And what they have found is people are coming to it in multiple different ways. So their experiment has been a very successful one in all sorts of ways. And I wanted to just briefly mention the Knowledge Commons, this nascent, exciting, dynamic movement. The social sciences and the humanities are certainly a part of that. A couple of examples are the EconPort project. This is a digital library for microeconomics research, and the Circle project, Center for Information Research on Civic Learning and Engagement. Amazing project. Peter Levine heads it up, where youth, high school students, are conducting and creating their own research and posting it onto this site. And my final comment comes from the Budapest Open Access Initiative, one of the most important initiatives ever. The first initiative to use the term open access. The initiative says, removing access barriers to the literature will accelerate research, enrich education, share the learning of the rich with the poor, and the poor with the rich, make this literature as useful as it could be, and lay the foundation for uniting humanity in a common intellectual conversation and quest for knowledge. Let's all make this happen. Thanks very much.
To engage the scientific community very much?
It's a brilliant question. There's a difference between what nature did and what we're doing. Nature did it at the peer reviewing stage, pre-publication peer review, whereas PLOS One is post-publication peer review. So there may be a difference. Once the paper's out there, we think the community is going to have more of an interest in actually annotating it. But you'll be interested to know that the editor of Nature and the editor of PLOS ONE were on public radio on the most prestigious radio station in Britain, the Today programme in the morning, everyone listens to it. The editor of Nature bet the editor of PLOS ONE a bottle of vintage champagne that this commenting feature will be a failure in 1 year. So we've got a year. If we want the champagne, we've got a year. Sorry?
When was it launched?
It was launched end of December. It's only got a few months' worth of content. We've got a year to win the champagne. But you're right, it is, to some extent, it's an unknown quantity. And certainly last week was a very important week for us, because three universities did this journal club. And it was fantastic. Spontaneously, we didn't pay them a bottle of champagne to do it. They spontaneously said, we want to do this. So I think there's going to probably, I don't know. I think that what will happen is, as people see the commenting and the value of the commenting, the thing will take off. But it's an experiment. You never know. You should go and find a paper and comment on it. That would be good. In fact, maybe, you could all do a journal club on a paper in PLOS ONE. I'm not sure how much social sciences stuff there is. At the moment, it's much more oriented towards kind of basic molecular stuff. And there's a bit of clinical medicine. There was a legal, a sort of law paper, a paper that I actually commented on. It was a paper on... an intervention to reduce the use of the way in which, I can't remember, men in Colorado were using prostitutes, and it was an intervention to reduce the rate of use of prostitution. And so there were lots of things wrong with the paper, I have to say. But firstly, the United Nations has argued that you shouldn't use the word prostitute anymore for a variety of reasons, that it's stigmatizing, it doesn't accurately describe what people do. So I did that little comment, and then actually got into a very interesting discussion with the authors about why they used that word and so on. So there you go. Hopefully you can find a paper for this journal club. Yes?
Can I ask a half-formed question?
Yes! I'll give you a half-baked answer.
Fair enough. Of course, present a very compelling case why, if logic were involved, we'd all move towards open access journals, but clearly we have not quite got there yet. So, I guess I'm thinking about the other forces that are at play here.
Yeah.
And the vested interest and so forth. How much of it is just kind of fear of these... these kind of traditional journals to switch over to a different model, and kind of be waiting for the early adopters to do it and to kind of pave the way. How much is sort of as being one way, right? These guys can flip over to open access, or you could see the creation of new journals, but who don't have the same sort of cachet. And for academics who are looking for tenure and other kinds of recognition, there's a barrier there.
Right.
So I just wonder, I guess, I don't know if you have a sense of these kinds of institutional and kind of psychological barriers and how they play out.
Yes, I mean, they're great questions, and I can certainly attempt to answer the issues that you've raised. Firstly, we're seeing a lot of movement in the rest of the publishing industry, which is great. We at PLOS cannot publish every paper. We were a small non-profit. That's never been our intention. We would like to see the whole industry be more socially responsive. And we're seeing exciting movements. For example, Elsevier and Springer, the three big biomedical publishers, are Elsevier, Springer, and Taylor & Francis. They own 60% of the world's knowledge right now, medical and scientific. Elsevier and Springer now offer an open access option for some of their journals, a fairly small number. It's an experiment. They're going slow. But for some of their journals, if the research funder will cover the costs of creating that PDF, they'll do open access with a Creative Commons attribution license. Something is happening. I mean, I think PLOS probably played a role, and other open access publishers played a role, and the NIH and the Wellcome. There is movement happening. One of the reasons that movement is happening is self-interest. The Wellcome Trust, the world's largest private biomedical research funder, has now made it a condition of receiving a grant. They're the most radical. A condition of receiving a grant that the final published work is open access. You can't get grant money unless you do this. Elsevier makes a huge amount of its money from publishing Wellcome Trust funded research. So if they don't get their act together, they're going to be in a bit of trouble. So that's one side. Then there's the other side, which is the tenure and promotion. My own gut feeling, and I have no data on this, it's just a gut feeling, is that's probably the biggest obstacle to what we're doing at PLOS, right? In the science world, there is this measure called the impact factor. It's supposed to be a measure of how important and influential your journal is. It's actually a very flawed measure. It doesn't tell you anything about the work of an individual. It's a completely anti-scientific measure. It's a for-profit company, Thomson Scientific, based in Philadelphia. They refuse to make their processes public. They're responsible only to their shareholder. I don't believe in it. However, people make decisions about the value and the worth of an academic based on the journal impact factor, the journals that have published their work. They might get money. I mean, I have a friend who's a researcher in Australia, and he says, every time, I can't do it in Australia now, Gavin, every time I get a paper that's in a journal with impact factor over 7, I get $10,000. You know, literally, people get money when their work appears in journals with high impact factors. Now, if that's what we're up against, the only way we can compete is to have high journal impact factors, right? We at PLOS don't believe in impact factors. Having said that, PLOS Biology happens to have the highest impact factor of any general biology journal, right? PLOS Medicine is in the top 5 or 6 journals. We're only 2 years old. We have the same impact factor as the BMJ, which is 200 years old. So by this anti-scientific, anti-democratic, rather ridiculous, flawed measure, we're doing very well. We've got this bizarre system where we've got this bizarre situation where we've got academics going, oh my God, this is amazing. You know, we can publish with you, we can still get tenure, and we've got this weird mixed feeling about it because we actually think that we as a community have to come up with way better measures than the impact factor of the value of a scientist's work. But it is not harming our case, right? You know, that paper on the world's first circumcision trial, arguably one of the most important, I mean, there were 2 more this year you may have heard about, so there are 3 now, but the very first one came to PLOS Medicine. You know, I don't know what made the researchers do that, but it, you know, this traditional measure is helping. Now, I think what the future requires is for sharing research to be valued in tenure decisions, right? I mean, that's what needs to happen. People need to be valued for publishing in open access journals. When Joe DeRisi, a researcher at UCSF, published his paper in the launch issue of PLOS Biology, the launch issue, I mean, how risky is that? The Chancellor of UCSF went public at the press conference to say, we are so proud of Joe for having done this. And that's what PLOS needs to see more happening. Because that is, I think, probably the greatest obstacle. You know, we'd love to publish with you, but the New England Journal has an impact factor of 25, that kind of thing. It's very hard to argue. And, you know, no one's going to read the paper in the New England Journal, or not no one, but only those who can afford a subscription. You know, I think there's a generational issue as well. I'm sure there is. I think, particularly if we can demonstrate the value of open access, and that's probably 5 years, something like that. The killer app, I had to learn what a killer app means, but apparently, as soon as we've got a killer app that shows what can happen with open access, the editor-in-chief of Computation Biology is convinced that once we've got a killer app, it's going to be very hard to continue to keep this knowledge locked away. And who knows what that's going to be, but he's working on the case.
Are there any open access universities?
Open Access University, I don't know, I mean, there's this, isn't there a lot going on here with courses being...
MIT's
famous...
I mean, universities that require their professors to only publish...
Oh, yes, they don't require you to publish, many. I mean, that's, 2006 was the year of Open Access, in all sorts of ways. One of the reasons was the huge number of universities that said to its scholars, we need you to make your work freely available. Now, they didn't say you need to publish in journal X, Y, and Z, but they said you need to archive your work in an institutional repository and we'll set one up. So there are now mandates. There are now mandates, an increasing number of university mandates, saying if you're a scholar at our university, we want you to put a copy of your work into our institutional repository.
For public viewing or for you, or for institutions?
For public viewing. I mean, that's one of the problems with repositories, right? Some repositories aren't public. Only, you know, only the university researchers can read it. And that sort of defeats the object a bit, really. But these mandates are usually around public access.
So there are universities where every professor, every paper published through the university is open access?
Well, I'm not saying it's happened, but I'm saying that there have been mandates, and I don't know what the rates of compliance are. I mean, some of these mandates are very new, you know, they're a few months old. And then there are questions of, well, how are we going to do it? You know, it takes time to put your paper into your e-print into an archive, and who's going to do that, and all that kind of stuff. So there are those issues still to be sorted out. Definitely. You've already asked one question, so I'll come back to you. Yes.
Do you know, are there any organizations or institutions working towards creating like an open source algorithm to sort of rival the impact factor, or?
That's a fantastic question. There are people coming up with alternatives. I mean, Google is coming up with an alternative. You know, I gave a talk recently to a group of social scientists, and they said, in our world, we've got all sorts of interesting ways of assessing what people do, and you should come and talk to us. Because, you know, when we publish a paper in PLOS Medicine, the citations we care about, and how many times it's been downloaded we care about, but actually what we care about more is, did something change as a result? You know, did health policy change? Did a foundation give a grant to address this problem raising it? So we need to come up with better ways of monitoring the impact of what we do in that way. It's not very easy to do, but there is a literature on this from the kind of the education world that we need to learn from. And yeah, there are people trying to come up with better measures. You know, the way in which the impact factor works, I mean, oh, don't get me started, but the impact factor, if you have a high journal impact factor, it usually means that you've published one or two papers that were very, 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 very highly cited. Most papers aren't. The company that measures impact factors, they don't even have the technology to work out how often an individual paper has been cited. They haven't got that technology. I don't know what they've been doing. And so they can't even tell you the impact of an individual. I mean, that would be a good start, right? Yeah. I mean, it's not great, but it's better than nothing. To find out how often, and in your paper, the paper that you published, how often did that get cited? They can't even do that, they don't have the technology. So they have to do this proxy measure of total citations to a journal. There you go. But if you'd like to help to come up with a better tool, if you're interested. No, I'm serious. If this is your expertise, we need to do better at PLOS at coming up with alternatives, and we haven't done that yet. So if you have an interest or expertise or both, please do come and help us.
I have an interest, but no expertise.
Well, that helps. Interest is a good start. Yes?
In broad terms, what do you see as the revenue model for humanities, for science, mass journals? And
yeah.
My worry is that it's going to end up resulting in just an invitation regime, or how it's really set up in many ways. A lot of universities or corporate sponsors paying for journals to publish.
Yeah, so, my battery's just died. So technology, that's great. The model that I wanted to show you is a model that John Walensky came up with from the Public Knowledge Project in Canada. They're moving to Stanford, which is exciting because we're at San Francisco and we hope to be working more. And he showed the sums of money involved and how it's possible to transition to open access. The assumptions were the following. One, you abandon print. Print's incredibly expensive, right? Or you do just print on demand. For those that want it, they can buy it. So you abandon print. Secondly, you transition to open source software, which is free. Thirdly, the money that gets saved from never having to subscribe to a journal again, that's a huge amount in medicine and science. It's not as huge in the social sciences, but it's pretty significant still. All that money that gets saved, you put half of it towards covering the costs of open access journals. And you run these as a cooperative, students and faculty and the academic publisher and the university. You cut your overheads by going to this open source software. You save money on, for example, Bizarrely, keeping, well, it's not that bizarre, maintaining a list of subscribers is actually very expensive to maintain that list. That disappears. And in Canada, there happens to be a federal program where every Canadian social sciences journal that's peer-reviewed gets around $30,000 in federal money. With all of that, he actually found that the transition would lead to additional revenue. So it's doable. It's absolutely doable.
Do you think you kind of advertising revenue?
I mean, we have advertising revenue in PLOS, right? So we have a mixed business model. I mean, we get... Right, I mean, there are lots of people who hate us for all sorts of reasons, but the people who hate us say, well, you know, you haven't shown immediately that you are sustainable on day one from publication charges. Well, firstly, it takes any new venture. A subscription-based journal takes 5 to 10 years before it breaks even, typically. Subscription-based, 5 to 10 years. So to hold us to this bizarre standard that on day one we have to be sustainable through publication charges seems rather ridiculous. Secondly, they hold us to the standard, you have to be sustainable only from publication charges to show the world that you have this fantastic business model. Again, that's bizarre. I don't know of any journal that doesn't have a mixed model. I used to be one of the editors of the BMJ, the British Medical Journal. We had a mixed model. Some subscriptions, advertising revenue, foundation support, selling value-added materials, kind of knowledge materials that pooled content. So why should we be held to a completely different standard? We happen to have a mixed model. We have foundation support. I don't have a problem with that. I happen to believe that we are a socially oriented non-profit, and if there are foundations that want to support what we do, that's fine. We have advertising. We don't advertise drugs and devices. We've got pretty lefty editors like myself who, when we started PLOS Medicine, said we need to break this ridiculous cycle of dependency on drug companies. What's this bizarre notion that journals can only survive with drug company money? We've got to destroy that. So we're the only medical journal that refuses to advertise drugs and devices, which has limited our revenue, but I think it's given us other benefits. But PLOS Biology's got full of ads and pipettes or something. PCR machines and all of that. So we have a mixed model. We have foundation support, we have advertising, we have publication charges, and we have universities that support us. Universities can become members of PLOS. They don't have to. No one has to do anything. All our journals are free to everyone, forever. But if they want to support us, they can fund us. They get a benefit because the publication charge for that university is lowered. But it's not a subscription. No one has to do it. They do it because they want to support us. So in a mixed model, this is completely viable. We also want to show that it is possible, actually, to be sustainable from publication charges alone. And these three community journals, run by the community, for the community, we deliberately launched those to show that these could break even from publication charges alone. And PLOS One will be revenue generating. Yes?
On that note, the American Chemical Society has recently come up with a so-called author choice option,
yeah.
Which sounds like an author could pay additional funds if they want to make their article open access. But the contingencies that they apply on that are really just an open access green model. So I didn't know if you had a comment on that or if this is a disturbing trend. Obviously, somebody's going to pay some money, then open access gold.
There is a trend. There is a rather bizarre trend. I mean, this sounds like an example of this bizarre trend, which is paying to be allowed to archive your work.
Which you're already entitled to do after 12 months in some cases.
Right. So I'm not sure that you get much value for money. I mean, you might have read that Elsevier last week did a deal with Howard Hughes Medical Institute, one of the largest medical research funders. And the deal, it's a step in the right direction, but again, it's where the authors can pay to archive their work. So I'm not sure it's the most radical.
It sounds to me like, from what it says on the site anyway,
yes,
archiving in some other institutional repository,
right,
something like it would be housed and protected and preserved at the...
Yes. I mean, one thing that we work hard at doing is that we are aware that the language of open access gets appropriated, right? The Lancet, one of the, you know, premier medical journals on the planet, great journal, calls itself an open access journal. It's ridiculous. It's a subscription-based journal. It happens to allow archiving, but not of the corrected version. And so, and the copyright still applies. And if you look at the definition of open access in the Budapest Open Access Initiative, it was very clear. This is not just about free to read, it's about free to use. Right? You need to be able to crawl and data mine and extract and do all the things that the web allows you to do that's going to generate new knowledge. I mean, that, in my view, is what true open access is about. And if we have this technology that's going to find new knowledge, why are we not doing it? You know, the same technology that allows all this to happen is being used by corporations to, you know, to lock it up, which is a tragedy, one of the great tragedies of our time. Yes.
I think we have time for
one more.
Question, so. Make it a good one.
Make it a good one. The pressure's on.
Okay.
You've got the best facial hair. That's a good start. So.
You mentioned that Duke people were coming to the large view through Westlaw and Lexis.
Yes, and the institutional repository.
And that makes sense to me in part because that's how people tend to find, you know, law articles, West Virginia, Westlaw. Like, there's nothing, for the most part, in most of the humanities areas that I'm familiar with, there isn't something like PubMed.
Right.
Or one of these freely available, you know, I mean, access to being able to do searches for articles have been free in bioscience and, you know, biohealth sciences for a while.
Yes.
I mean, you get to the point where you want to see the article or maybe even the abstract underneath the wall.
Yes.
If that doesn't exist, are we supposed to, that's been funded in part because, you know, I mean, PubMed is built by the funding agencies, which are, you know, have a bunch of money.
The NIH, right.
Which is
yes.
very particular to the biosciences. Also,
yes.
Who's going to build the similar system?
So there's no search engine apart from these law ones.
There's no
social sciences search engine.
I mean, we just,
wow.
Google's working on it.
Yeah.
I mean, do we just hope
yeah.
that Google does it? I mean, I don't know, that seems kind of like not an answer I'm entirely comfortable with, but maybe it's the best one.
Well, no, I mean, as I said, I don't know anything about...
Seems like it's another missing piece.
Absolutely. I couldn't do my job as a journalist and physician and editor
right.
without this search engine that I use every single day, Medline. Every single
right.
day. I don't know, I really couldn't operate. So it's striking that there isn't something similar in the social sciences.
So there are sometimes similar ones. They're usually owned by people.
I see. They're proprietary. You have to pay.
That's right.
The
search engines themselves are frequently
right.
proprietary.
Right.
Yes. And so it's just another thing, sort of.
Yeah.
Online.
Yeah.
And so even if we have, you know, convince everyone to release
yeah.
their papers, we still, you know.
But then the open access social sciences movement has to work on creating an open source
right.
search engine. Absolutely,
right.
top priority. And you're the one to do it.
Thank you very much.